This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests are two journalists risking imprisonment for refusing to reveal their confidential sources to a federal grand jury. Judith Miller is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for The New York Times. Matt Cooper is a White House correspondent for Time magazine. Last week, a federal appeals court decided the two reporters must face up to 18 months in jail unless they reveal their sources to a grand jury which is investigating who leaked that Valerie Plame was a covert CIA officer. Plame is married to former Ambassador Joseph Wilson. Her undercover status was leaked a few days after Wilson wrote an op-ed article in the New York Times in July of 2003, contradicting President Bush's statement that Iraq was trying to buy material for nuclear weapons in the African country Niger. Wilson's criticisms were based on a trip he took to Niger to investigate that issue for the CIA. Many people believe Plame's name was leaked as payback for Wilson's criticism of the president. The leak was published in a column by Robert Novak. Neither Matt Cooper nor Judith Miller published leaked information about Plame. Cooper co-wrote an article covering the aftershocks of the leak, and in that article mentioned that Time had been approached with similar information. Judith Miller had researched the story, but she never published it. Miller and Cooper are planning to appeal the court's decision. Also with us is their lawyer, Floyd Abrams, who is arguably the top First Amendment media lawyer in the country. He was co-counsel to the New York Times in the Pentagon Papers case. Matt Cooper, in the article that you wrote about, you didn't actually publish the information. You weren't the person who broke the story about Valerie Plame being an undercover agent.
That's correct.
So what is at issue here, since you didn't break the story?
Well, Robert Novak, the conservative columnist, is the one who used Ms. Plame's name in print first, and he, in effect, broke the story. A few days later, I wrote a story basically trying to call attention to these leaks and suggesting that they were nefarious and that they were worthy of examination. And in the course of that piece, I noted that people had made government officials was the phrase I used, had made similar claims to Time about Ms. Plame. And that seems to be what caught the eye of the special prosecutor.
And you didn't even say to you personally, you said to Time.
I did say to Time, that's correct.
Mm-hmm. And Floyd Abrams, let me ask you, you know, Judy Miller didn't publish anything her sources told her. She decided not to write about this. Is this unprecedented in any way that you would be held in contempt for not revealing sources whose information you didn't publish?
For a journalist, it probably is, because, for one thing, the government would rarely know the name of a journalist to call unless the journalist published a story. In the ordinary confidential source case that gets to court, a journalist has written something or said something on the air, and some government prosecutor or some defense lawyer thinks it would be useful in one way or another to get the person's name who is the source of the story. In this case, it appears that perhaps someone testified in front of the grand jury and mentioned Judy Miller's name. Matt's name they knew in the first instance because he had written a piece. So it is unusual, maybe unprecedented, for a journalist to be called who has not published a story at all. Legally, it doesn't make a lot of difference, but as a matter of fact, it probably never has happened in this way before.
Judy Miller, why have you refused to name your sources?
Because in investigative journalism, confidential sources are really the life's blood of what we do. We can't operate without people who are willing to take a chance on us, that is, to come forward with either a minority or dissenting view or allegations of wrongdoing or fraud or corruption in the agencies or companies in which they work. And it is our kind of sacred obligation of, as journalists, to protect their identity if, in fact, what they tell us is true and they're not lying, or even if they're acting in good faith. And in an era in which it's getting harder and harder to get people to come forward with such information because so much more is classified after 9/11, it's really vital that these people have confidence in us. So I think I feel that I just won't be able to do my job if I don't protect the identity of people who trust me to safeguard it. And look, Terry, I know journalists and journalism are not perfect, but by and large, you know, we come out every day. A lot of what the public knows about how governments and powerful corporations operate is because of a free press, and I think that that is worth standing on your principles for. I just don't feel I have much of a choice here.
Matt Cooper, why are you refusing to name your sources?
Well, I'd echo the same things Judy said. It's very difficult to function as a journalist unless one is able to keep confidences. You know, Terry, what we're seeking in the courts here is not something especially exotic or far out or some special privilege that we think that we're only entitled to. You know, as a society, we've granted privileges of confidentiality to priests and rabbis and imams and psychotherapists and social workers. These have all been well established in the courts by now. And in 31 states, journalists clearly have these kinds of source confidences protected by law. We're seeking to, you know, make it clear in the federal courts, which is where our case has landed, that we have the same kind of privilege.
Floyd Abrams, I think it's fair to say you're America's best-known First Amendment lawyer when it comes to the media, and you're representing Matt Cooper and Judith Miller. What do you think are the larger principles at stake for the public and for the press?
Well, really, the ultimate principle here, the ultimate question here, is whether journalists are going to be able to continue to promise confidentiality to sources, especially when they cover the government. I don't think that we can go on as a society asking journalists, to go to jail as a price tag for doing their job. We really shouldn't live in a system, I think, in which a journalist can't know in the first instance whether he or she will wind up called by a grand jury in a federal court or a state court or a federal grand jury rather than a state grand jury, where the difference between the two is that in one case they're absolutely protected and the other is they may have no protection at all.
Can you explain a little bit more the difference between what the state laws cover that shield journalists and what the federal law says?
Yeah. As Matt said earlier, 31 states have laws literally written down, adopted by state legislatures, and 18 more have decisions by courts, 49 out of 50, saying that journalists in most or all circumstances may refuse to reveal their confidential sources to state grand juries, to state courts, to state legislative committees, or the like. And so in a typical murder case, say, there are privileges, so to speak, which exist for journalists in just about all the states that allow them to say, just as I can say as a lawyer, I can't tell you that because I got it in confidence. In the federal courts, the law is a lot less clear. One of the things this case may or may not do is to clarify that. But what the Court of Appeals has said in our case so far is that while there is protection for journalists in civil cases and maybe even in criminal cases, not so in a grand jury context. The grand juries have free rein to call a journalist, demand that the journalist reveal his or her confidential source, and punish a journalist if the journalist keeps his or her word and doesn't reveal who the source is.
Can you explain why the grand jury is considered different than other legal settings and why journalists are required in some instances to reveal sources to grand juries?
Well, the theory in some decisions is that grand juries are sort of specially empowered to find out what the facts are so that they can decide who to charge. Grand juries are not held to ordinary standards of relevance, to ordinary standards having to ask questions which are narrow and precise and the like. And the whole idea, some judges believe, of a grand jury, you know, is to be freewheeling in their effort to find out the facts. Grand juries can listen to hearsay, for example, what one person says another person said to a third person. No court would take such evidence, but a grand jury can in gathering information. Now, I would argue that means we have a need for more care in grand juries so as not to let them trample lightly journalists who have made promises to their sources. But there are some cases which came out against the press. There are some which have come out for the press, but there are some which have come out badly for the press, in the grand jury context particularly.
My guests are journalists Matt Cooper and Judith Miller and lawyer Floyd Abrams. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Matt Cooper of Time Magazine, Judith Miller of the New York Times, and their lawyer Floyd Abrams. Cooper and Miller are risking imprisonment for refusing to reveal confidential sources to a federal grand jury investigating who leaked that Valerie Plame was an undercover officer for the CIA. Now, what makes this leak and this source atypical is that the act of leaking was a crime in and of itself, because what was being leaked was the information of a CIA agent's identity, and there's a law making that illegal. There's a law that prevents, that makes it illegal to reveal the identity of a CIA agent. So let me ask you, Judy and Matt, as reporters getting this information, and you know that it's illegal to reveal this information, would it have ever entered your mind to turn the source in, to report on the source? I mean, I don't mean to report in the paper. I mean to report to the authorities the fact that this source was committing a crime while they were speaking to you.
Well, Terry, it's not entirely clear it was a crime. I mean, this statute governing leaks is a fairly complicated and untested one, and it's very hard to prove, even if this special prosecutor were to identify the various leakers. Even if they were to do that, there's no guarantee that they could convict them. It's very hard. They have to have had intent. They have to have been at a certain level of, have obtained the name of the person in the course of their work. Floyd can elaborate better on the legal standards, but it's not cut and dry what is and isn't a crime under this statute. Let me just say, I think it's not the criminality as such of the leak that I think should be determinative of whether a reporter betrays his source. I mean, many leaks have involved to some degree a degree of criminality. I think in some of the high-profile business cases like Enron and MCI, WorldCom, there were some questions as to whether the person was legally entitled to be making the leaks. Were they stealing intellectual property and such? Certainly the Pentagon Papers, which Floyd does well, involved the divulging of classified material, which in itself was, I assume, a crime at the time. So in the past, we've certainly protected confidences of leakers that were involved in a degree of criminality. What's different here, of course, is that the leaks seem to have been of a nefarious nature and of a kind that most people consider odious rather than in the public good. But I think, you know, a confidence is a confidence, and it's hard to betray. It's hard for reporters to pick and choose what's a good leak and a bad leak.
And I would just add one thing to what Matt said, Terry, which is we're not even sure that Valerie Plame was covered by this law. I mean, that's one of the many, many questions that we don't know the answer to, because the law is very specific about what constitutes a covert agent. It's not a crime to leak the name of a CIA official. It may be a crime to, under certain circumstances, to leak the name of someone who was undercover, in deep cover, overseas for at least, you know, in the past 5 years, acting that way. And we're not even certain that Valerie Plame met those standards. It's this inability to have the facts in the case that I think complicates Floyd's ability to defend us and our ability to defend ourselves.
Mm. And why don't you know that information?
Well, we don't know it because the courts have said that since the information is to be found in grand jury testimony, that by its nature is secret. So even when we have said to the judges, just let us as lawyers see it. We won't even show it to Judy and Matt if you tell us not to. Let us see it so we can write briefs to you, arguing to you that the government hasn't met whatever legal tests it has to meet, or arguing to you maybe that maybe she wasn't a covert agent at all. But the answer has been no. That's all secret. We'll look at that ourselves. One of the opinions in this case contains 8 blank pages, literally white page after white page, not on the original. The original is filled, I'm sure, with information. But even for the lawyers here, we're not allowed to see what it is that the government has submitted in this case, which has persuaded judges that if there's some balance to be struck here, that we're on the wrong side of the balance.
Floyd Abrams, I know grand jury testimony isn't public, but would you be willing to discuss some of the argument that you made in court on behalf of Judy Miller and Matt Cooper not revealing their sources?
Sure. One of the things I said, which we haven't touched on yet here, starts with the proposition that, as we've said, 49 states now have legal protection for journalists with respect to what they say in front of state grand juries or state bodies or state courts or the like. And we argue that in a similar way that the federal courts have ruled that psychotherapists and social workers are entitled to a federal privilege, in part because they have state privileges in all 50 states. So here, we argue that the courts should say that it really serves the public for journalists to be able to protect their confidential sources, and that has been established and established without any real problems in all of these state courts that now have this protection. And so we argue that it is time for the federal courts to say that there is a federal privilege as well. And one of the 3 judges agreed with that, although he said he thought it should not be an absolute privilege but a qualified one. And another one may agree and did not reach the issue. So that's one of the things we talked about. The other main thing we talked about was the First Amendment.
The 3 judges in this case ruled against you. Floyd Abrams, could you just summarize what the reasons were?
I'm not sure I want to, but what they said was, as regards the First Amendment, they said that a 1972 Supreme Court opinion in the Brandsburg case had, in their view, concluded that there was no protection for journalists in front of a federal grand jury. And on the argument that there should be a common law, a judge-made protection for journalists, the court disagreed very thoroughly internally. As I said, one judge said, yes, I agree with you that sort of protection exists, and I'm ready to say that it exists. But I think on these facts, these journalists ought to have to reveal their sources. Another judge said, no, there's no such protection at all. And the third judge said, I don't have to decide that yet, and I'm not going to decide it yet. But I think that even if there is such protection, that the need for the information is so great, again, because it's a grand jury and looking into these matters, the need is so great that I'm going to vote against the journalists anyway.
Now, in the Supreme Court decision of 1972, that's the precedent that the appeals court was following, Justice Byron White wrote that they were going to decline to grant newsmen a testimonial privilege that other citizens don't have. Did you think that you were going to be able to succeed in the light of that precedent?
Well, I was certainly aware of the precedent, and indeed I was in court on the day when that case was argued. What we had argued about that was that even though the opinion was a 5-4 opinion, that the fifth vote was that of Justice Powell, who also wrote a separate opinion, a concurring opinion, in which he basically said in none too clear language, but nonetheless said that there was a balancing test which ought to be followed, that the First Amendment still existed in this area, and that courts ought to engage in a sort of case-by-case balancing, assessing how much the government needed the information and how much the cause of providing information to the public via confidential sources would be harmed by requiring a journalist to testify. And so our reading of the case was that since it was a 5-4 opinion, that fifth vote, which was indispensable for the majority, was what should be understood to be the key opinion in the case. The three-judge court did not agree with us on that, and that is certainly one of the things that we will argue when we, if we have to go to the U.S. Supreme Court on this.
Journalists Judith Miller and Matt Cooper and First Amendment lawyer Floyd Abrams will be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Judith Miller, a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative reporter for The New York Times, and Matt Cooper, White House correspondent for Time magazine. They're facing up to 18 months in prison for refusing to name confidential sources to a federal grand jury, which is investigating who leaked that Valerie Plame worked as a covert officer for the CIA. Last week, a federal appeals court said they needed to comply with the grand jury. Miller and Cooper are pursuing the appeals process. Also with us is their lawyer, Floyd Abrams. He represented the New York Times in the Pentagon Papers case. I asked him about the Supreme Court case that set the precedent, which the appeals court based its decision on. Did the 1972 Brandsburg case, the case that sets the precedent for revealing sources, did that case in its time influence press coverage of Watergate or the Vietnam War?
No, because it really has not been enforced in a way that much interfered with the journalistic process. I mean, if we're told now that what Brandsburg means, indeed what some judges are saying, what Brandsburg clearly means is that journalists just don't have any protection. That sure isn't the way it's been read for the last 30 years, and that's the reason that the case has not interfered with journalists going about their business.
Judy Miller, you've said, I risk going to jail for a story I didn't write for reasons a court won't explain. Can you elaborate on that?
Well, I was just referring to what Floyd discussed earlier, which was those 8 blank pages, 4 of which are devoted to Matt and 4 of which are devoted to me, when this one judge discussed the balancing test, what the judge thought, why he thought it, why he thought the balance rested with the grand jury, we don't know. And I just find this, I'm sorry, but a little Orwellian.
Matt Cooper, Judy Miller, you both spoke with a source or sources who revealed the identity of Valerie Plame. But Judy Miller, you didn't write about it at all. And Matt Cooper, you didn't break the story. You just wrote about the story after it was broken. You wrote about the phenomenon of the story after Robert Novak actually leaked Valerie Plame's identity. Now, Robert Novak, no one really knows what the story is with Robert Novak. You are both being held in contempt. No one really knows whether he cut a deal with a special prosecutor or whether he's told them who his sources were or not. And I'm wondering, what are some of the questions you have about Robert Novak's role and his relationship to this grand jury and how that affects you?
Well, it would be helpful for us to know what Mr. Novak has done because it pertains to our case. I mean, if the prosecutor knows what he needs to know in the case of this leak investigation, basically has everything and is just using Judy and I to dot I's and cross T's, that's germane to our case because, you know, one of these balancing questions is the information absolutely essential that you're seeking to get the reporter to testify to? So Floyd can elaborate better, but it would certainly be helpful to know what Novak has done.
And just one small correction, Terry. I have never said that anybody told me the identity of Valerie Plame, that anyone revealed her name. I haven't said anything about what I knew at the time, which is because I didn't write anything.
Got it. I should mention here that we've contacted Bob Novak's offices and asked for his comment, and he has declined, as he's declined the requests of many other journalists. Matt Cooper, you've been quoted as saying it's bizarre and disappointing that Robert Novak hasn't said Judy and Matt shouldn't go to jail. Were you expecting him to say something like that, and do you think he could say something like that in the position that he's in?
Well, he's certainly legally able to say something like that. Look, I'm perfectly willing to say that Robert Novak should enjoy the same protections as Judy and I, that he shouldn't be coerced into divulging sources. I don't want to see that. I meant in that quote, which I made to the New York Times, I just wished he had expressed the same degree of solidarity with fellow journalists here, but he hasn't chosen to, and that's his prerogative. If I could make one other point here, you know, there's a tendency in our polarized country to see so many issues in left-right terms, and I think it's important to note that this is not a left-right issue here. Right now in Congress, two conservative Republicans, Mike Pence in the House of Representatives and Richard Lugar in the Senate, are offering a bill that would offer a great deal of clarity to this legal situation by creating a federal shield law for journalists such as Judy and myself. It would just be a mistake for listeners to think that this is kind of a left-right issue here. Lots of conservatives support our case, and it's I think more a question of First Amendment than anything else.
Well, and since you brought up a question of left and right, I think a lot of our listeners will be wondering whether you, the parties involved, see your situation as being part of a larger conflict between the Bush administration and the press.
Well, I think there have been some run-ins between the Bush administration and the press because they've had a penchant for secrecy. There's, as Judy can speak to it better than I, there's been a large degree of classification of documents that heretofore weren't, and tensions between the White House press corps, of which I'm a part of, and the White House have been rough at times. But, I certainly don't feel a victim of a political persecution per se. As I said, the politics of this are quite muddled. There are Republicans in Congress who are trying to create a shield law for journalists. On the other hand, it were mostly Democrats who called for this special counsel in the first place. So the politics here are quite muddled.
Judy, what do you have to say?
I would essentially agree with that. I would just point out one other thing, too, which is, ironically, I think that if the Bush administration's Justice Department still had control of this case, there'd be some kind of sane standards eventually. I mean, someone would make a political judgment about whether or not this is palatable to the public, you know, putting journalists in jail for things they didn't write or for doing their jobs. When you get a special prosecutor, as we saw with Bill Clinton, as we've seen in many other cases, you get an individual who really is committed to kind of, you know, bringing a prosecution. And, you know, I think there is a tendency when this is your sole mission and mandate in life to kind of go get your man or your person. And I wonder if that isn't a factor here. I have the highest regard for Mr. Fitzgerald. I used to watch him when he was prosecuting Al-Qaeda cases, and I just wish that he were still doing that.
Matt Cooper, you are refusing to divulge your sources. However, you did decide to divulge one source, Louis Libby, after he agreed to release you from the confidentiality pledges, like a waiver of confidentiality. Can you talk about your decision in doing that and how you feel about this kind of new emphasis on the confidentiality waiver?
Sure, Terry. Just to review the facts, I had—this is actually my second subpoena. I had gotten one last year that was of a more limited nature. The current one is basically for everything that's in my notebook related to these stories. But the first one was quite focused. It asked about my conversations with one individual, Louis Libby, the vice president's chief of staff. And we fought that in the courts. And at a certain point, we thought we would just go to the source himself and seek his unambiguous, clear waiver and see if he was willing to grant it. And if he was, I was certainly willing to give testimony. You know, the idea of this source protection is to protect the source. And if the source wants you to speak, it's my feeling, others might disagree, that, you know, there's really no problem in coming forward. If otherwise, you're hanging by the branch of a principle and the tree walks away. And I think there's really no reason not to speak. And so I reached out to Louis Libby and got his personal unambiguous waiver. And then I gave testimony to the special counsel last August. And in fact, he accepted my testimony and my contempt citation at that time was cleared. I was in the legal clear. And, you know, I think there's certainly times when reporters, you know, can feel comfortable talking to grand juries or court settings if they're not dealing with confidential sources or the source gives them a waiver. I'm not a zealot about these matters, but you know, the subpoena I'm under now is much more sweeping and much harder to comply with.
Well, I want to thank you all, Junie Miller, Matt Cooper, Floyd Abrams. Thank you for being with us.
Thank you, Terry.
Thanks. Thank you.
Journalists Matt Cooper and Judith Miller are risking imprisonment for refusing to reveal the names of confidential sources to a federal grand jury. Floyd Abrams is their lawyer. We invited several people to talk with us who declined. Special Prosecutor Patrick Fitzgerald, Judges David Sentell and David Tatel of the U.S. District Court of Appeals, and columnist Robert Novak. Coming up, we speak with Steve Chapman, a syndicated columnist who thinks Cooper and Miller should reveal their sources. This is Fresh Air. Journalists Judith Miller and Matt Cooper just explained why they're risking imprisonment rather than revealing the names of confidential sources to a federal grand jury. The grand jury is investigating who leaked that Valerie Plame was an undercover officer for the CIA. My guest Steve Chapman writes a syndicated column for the Chicago Tribune and is a member of the paper's editorial board. He thinks Miller and Cooper should reveal their sources to the grand jury. Steve Chapman, as you have pointed out in one of your op-ed pieces, the news media have sided strongly with reporters Judith Miller and Matthew Cooper, but you say that this is a battle the press can't win and doesn't deserve to win. Why not?
Well, I think journalists are citizens first, and one of the prime obligations of citizenship is to cooperate with law enforcement. When an ordinary person is witness to a crime, he or she is liable to be called to testify before a grand jury about it, and most people accept that obligation as a matter of routine. And I don't think really journalists are any different from anybody else in this situation, and I think when you have a case like this where two journalists apparently were witnesses to a federal crime, a very serious felony, they have the same duty as anybody else.
Now, Floyd Abrams, who is the lawyer for Cooper and Miller, says that the law is actually unspecific about what constitutes a covert agent, and he's not even sure if Valerie Plame meets the test and whether she'd be covered by the law, and he's not being given enough information to help him understand that.
Well, two things I would say about that. The first is he had a chance to raise those points in court. Two federal courts, a district court and an appeals court, have found that there's sufficient evidence that a crime was committed to proceed with the grand jury investigation. I think that's why we have courts, to make decisions like that. If you have a disagreement between lawyers about whether a crime has been committed, then you turn it over to the judge and the judge makes a decision. Two different courts have ruled against Mr. Abrams. He's a legendary First Amendment lawyer. I have great respect for him, but in this case, he's lost that argument. The other point I would make is that Patrick Fitzgerald is a very highly regarded career prosecutor who was brought in as a special counsel in this investigation after the Attorney General John Ashcroft disqualified himself. And one thing prosecutors have a lot of experience at is looking at cases, deciding there is not enough evidence that a crime was committed, deciding there's not enough evidence to convict somebody of a crime, and walking away from the case. Patrick Fitzgerald doesn't need the publicity. He's gotten plenty out here. He's not a cowboy. He's not a grandstander. And I don't think he would be pressing forward with this case if he weren't very convinced that a crime has been committed.
Now, Floyd Abrams says that this is really not a black and white issue, that in the 1972 Supreme Court case that is being used as the precedent for the Federal Appeals Court decision, that Justice Lewis Powell wrote in an agreement with the majority that actually there was a balancing test that should be required in situations of confidentiality, and the courts should engage in a case-by-case call, balancing how much the government needs the information versus how much the cause of journalism would be harmed by revealing confidential sources. So, you know, he's saying, look, this is not black and white.
Well, again, two courts have found that the Supreme Court decision on this is dispositive, that there's basically no First Amendment privilege for reporters to refuse to testify in a grand jury investigation. The Powell opinion in that case, that concurrence, doesn't give them much room to argue that there's a balancing test. About all Justice Powell said was that a grand jury has to be acting in good faith, and if it's not, then you can't force a journalist to testify. Nobody's alleged that this grand jury is not acting in good faith. The other point I want to make about that is if you look at the district court decision and the appeals court decision, both of them engaged basically in a balancing test. They found that this was direct evidence of a crime, of guilt or innocence, that it was a very narrow inquiry by the prosecutor, and that there was no other way to get this information. If you look at the sort of conditions that are set up in most state shield laws to try and limit the exposure of journalists to these kind of subpoenas, those conditions have already been met.
Even if Miller and Cooper were witnesses to a crime, and they're not saying that they were, what kind of precedent would this set if they were sent to prison for not revealing their sources? You know, they're saying you don't know what information is going to be leaked to you when you're a journalist. Are you concerned that in some cases a whistleblower would be breaking the law for the larger good, revealing a secret document that the revealed wrongdoing that the public should know about, but there'd be a law against revealing this secret document, for example?
Well, of course, a lot of leaks are illegal, and they're not prosecuted, and they shouldn't be prosecuted because they do serve a public good. And a lot of the state laws have a condition in them that says, you know, even if this was against the law, and even if the journalist knows who committed the crime, we're not going to make the journalist testify because the disclosure itself served the public interest. And I would like to see a federal shield law that would incorporate a standard like that. Unfortunately, we don't have one. And unfortunately, even if we had one, I don't think Miller and Cooper would qualify under this because the leak itself was really of no public value. It was just a matter of political retribution from all we can tell.
Could you argue that Miller and Cooper did their job quite well? Well, Miller's not even saying what information, if any, she got. But Cooper is saying that Time magazine was leaked information. But neither Cooper nor Miller published that information. So, you know, they're being prosecuted for information they didn't even publish.
Well, Time magazine actually did publish it, a reference to the fact that sources in the administration were trying to get Valerie Plame's name out. This was after
but
the
that,
Novak
that,
column.
That was after the Novak column,
right,
so they didn't break anything.
No, they didn't break the story. But, you know, Patrick Fitzgerald is not going after them because they wrote about it. He's going after them because they were witnesses to a crime, basically, because the disclosure is the crime, not printing the name. Robert Novak's not being prosecuted because he didn't commit any crime. It's not a crime to print Valerie Plame's name. It's only a crime for a federal employee to leak that name.
What do you make of Robert Novak's silence on this issue? A lot of people are assuming this. If he hasn't cooperated with the grand jury, then how come he isn't being threatened with prison? And if he has cooperated with the grand jury, then doesn't the grand jury have the information it needs about who's behind the leak, and why do they need it from Mueller and Cooper?
Well, as you know, grand jury proceedings are secret. Prosecutors don't talk about them. People who are called before them are free to talk about them if they want. Novak has refused to comment on whether he's been subpoenaed and on whether he's testified. From that, my assumption is that he has been subpoenaed and he has testified. Under what terms, I don't know. The reason that might not settle the case and let Mueller make Mueller and Cooper kind of unnecessary for this investigation, there could be a few explanations. One is that you don't want to go to court with only one person's word against another. So if Novak says so-and-so leaked it to me and so-and-so says no, I didn't, it would be very helpful, probably critical to a prosecution, to have another witness who can say, well, actually that source leaked it to me as well. That would greatly strengthen the case. The other possible explanation is that Novak sources may not be the same as Mueller and Cooper's sources. You could have had several people in the administration who were peddling this information, trying to get it out, and some of them called Novak, some of them called Mueller, some of them called Cooper. They may not all be the same one.
Novak witnessed a crime, if a crime was committed, when the source handed over the information about Valerie Plame. Novak printed that information, which revealed the undercover identity of Valerie Plame. So, you know, wouldn't he be at least complicit in that crime?
Well, it's not a crime to print the name. If it were, then a lot of leaks that involved classified information would be crimes on the part of newspapers and broadcast outlets. I guess if Novak was a witness to a crime and he gave the evidence to a grand jury, he's discharged his legal obligation. The fact that he printed it may be grounds for journalists to hold him in contempt, but it's not grounds for a grand jury to hold him in contempt or a court to hold him in contempt.
My guest is Steve Chapman. He writes a syndicated column for the Chicago Tribune. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air.